Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is David Buckley, the Paul J. Weber Chair in Politics, Science, and Religion, and Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Louisville. Professor Buckley specializes in the study of religion and politics, having completed his PhD at Georgetown University, and where he also served as a graduate research fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. In his relatively young career, he has authored 8 peer-reviewed articles in journals such as Comparative Politics, Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion, Comparative Political Studies, and West European Politics, where he won the Gordon Smith and Vincent Wright Memorial Prize for that article in West European Politics. David is also working on a book manuscript tentatively entitled Faithful to Secularism, Political Institutions and the Religious Politics of Democracy. His article in Comparative Political Studies entitled Demanding the Divine, Explaining Cross-National Support for Clerical Control of Politics will be the topic of our discussion today. Professor Buckley is also the recipient of a Cosmos Foundation Fellowship. And if you want to learn more about Professor Buckley, check out our website, www.researchonreligion.org, where we will put links to his bio and many of his writings right there. So check it out. Dave, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks very much, Tony. It's great to be here with you today. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Hey, a few weeks back, we had Nancy Abrams talking about cosmology and religion. And you, I see here in your bio, you were the recipient of this Cosmos Foundation Fellowship. And I've never heard of that, but are you moonlighting as an astronomer when you're not doing political science?
That's right. Yeah, you know, we've got a planetarium here on campus at U of L that they let us kind of just wander into and take up readings in our free time. The Cosmos Foundation is actually a foundation that's based out of Washington D.C. that gives, among other things, support to grad students at universities in the D.C. metro area. So it's a nice resource for doctoral candidates in the D.C. area, all across the board. They fund a whole range of things.
Okay. It sounds a little trilateral commission there. You know, a little spooky. Actually, where did this Cosmos Foundation come from?
It's based out of one of the social clubs, actually, in D.C., which is called, I think, the Cosmos Club. So it's one of the old, the great and the good, so to speak.
Oh, it's one of those in-club things. I don't get invited to those in-club things. Yeah. All right. Well, let's put Cosmos aside, cosmology and cosmopolitans too. You're a pretty young scholar still, being still an assistant professor and all, but I have to say you have a very strong publication record for somebody just a few years out from your PhD. So that bodes well for tenure, I think. But here's my problem, or my question, I should say. Young folks like you aren't supposed to be interested in religion, right? All that stuff, you're millennials, you're cycling out of the religious world and, you know, secularization, all that kind of stuff. So how did you come to make religion the focus of your graduate and professional research?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? I mean, particularly, I think it's easier to do this stuff within political science now than it was when you started doing it.
Well, let me tell you.
but it's still not, right? It's still not, you know, exactly the always seen as the mainstream of the discipline. I mean, honestly, biographically, I got interested in, first, in the role of religion in ethnic conflict zones. So while I was an undergraduate at University of Virginia, I did an undergrad thesis on the sort of contestation between militant groups and religious leaders in Northern Ireland and in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that led to then a master's in Belfast, at Queen's Belfast, looking at patterns of cooperation and contestation between religious elites and different paramilitary groups. So that was sort of my gateway drug, I guess, for the study of religion and politics, and an area where there is more, obviously, historically, research on the relationship between religion and politics in conflict zones. But as life went on, I got more interested actually in the relationship between religion and democratic politics, moving in more from conflict periods and conflict zones into more settled periods of democratic life. Some of that was driven by looking at the American case and you know, just observing in the particularly around the sort of early, the first, let's say, 4 to 6 years of the George W. Bush administration, the role of the Christian right, the reaction from an increasingly secular left, and the, all the political dynamics around the 2004 campaign, right? All of that to me really was just interesting. I wasn't in grad school at that point in time, but I was very interested by it. And so when I, you know, eventually applied to grad school and started framing a dissertation project, it was those interests that kind of motivated me. Looking on the one hand at instances where religious groups have a lot of influence in democratic politics, but also looking at limitations on that influence and cases where religious and secular groups might even work together more closely than we sometimes assume here in the United States in particular.
Yeah, you take a more global approach, too, and I think in part you're hanging around the D.C. area there at Georgetown University, so I'm sure that the influences there played a role.
Yeah, I mean, Georgetown is a, you know, there are a lot of very supportive resources there for the study of religion and politics. The Berkeley Center is you know, obviously institutionally committed to improving both graduate scholarship and also relationships between scholars and policymakers in this area, and that was a huge support. I think you don't have to defend if you go through the government department at Georgetown and you're interested in religion and politics stuff. You don't have to explain why, right? There's a understanding of that and a support for that kind of research, and that extends to great scholars like Clyde Wilcox on the American side of things, and comparativists like Tom Banchoff, and even over into sociology with Jose Casanova, all of whom were just wonderful supportive resources for me. That Georgetown was a great perch, and if there are any prospective graduate students thinking about graduate work related to religion within a political science department, I think it's worth taking a serious look at that program.
Yeah, after they looked at the University of Washington, of course.
Obviously.
Yeah. Anyways, I know Clyde and his work and stuff like that, so you were definitely in good company there. Now, one of the things that I'd like about your comparative political studies article, and this is going to be the topic of our discussion here today, is the question that you ask. You reframe the question that researchers have been kind of putting their finger on, but really haven't asked it the way that you are doing. And what you ask is the topic is whether or not citizens in a country have a preference or a demand for having clergy involved in politics. And that's kind of an interesting question. You know, why would me, average Joe citizen, want a pastor or a priest to somehow engage in politics? You asked that question. I thought it's a great question. How did you come about to that topic?
I think it was there were two sides to it. One was honestly driven by how religious actors are talked about in sort of public policy discussions and in the news media. I think there's a frequent assumption, right, an unquestioned assumption, but an assumption, that demand was high, right, especially among the most religious people, that these things went together, right, that it was just a natural relationship. That, of course, as you are personally religious, you want your religious leader to get involved in politics. Why would you even need to ask the question? And yet, particularly in cases in parts of the developing world where I'd spent some time for field work, you know, I just had an instinct that it was more complex than that, right? That even in, to give one example, Senegal, a consolidated democracy in sub-Saharan Africa, but very both religiously devout and economically low status in comparative perspective. The fact of the matter is your average citizen has kind of mixed feelings about religious leaders getting involved in politics, and the religious leaders know it, right? So they actually sort of self-restrain themselves a bit when it comes to political influence. So anyway, I had some instincts from time in the field and that this assumption about high demand among high religiosity individuals needed to be looked at a little more carefully. So that was half of the story.
Yeah, I have to pause you here too. That the question and how you framed it, I thought was very interesting, because I think you're correct to say that's the natural assumption. Religious people would just love to have their priests and pastors involved in politics. But, you know, now I come to think about it, like, I have a high demand for taverns, but I don't want my bartender to be in politics, right? So why would I want that? I guess maybe there's something a little bit different about that. But it's a really nice question. And the reason I liked your article so much was because you asked that different question based upon that assumption that had gone unquestioned for a long period of time. So, okay, so that's one reason. What other reasons motivated you on this question?
The other one is honestly a little bit strategic. It was just that there'd been so much attention to when religious political parties, especially, are supplied and what explains their success, right? So, you know, classics from Carolyn Warner and Thaddeus Kalivas, and you know, going back even to the sort of foundations of modern comparative politics in Lipset and Roken's research, right? There's stuff on religious political parties, where they come from, when they succeed. But there wasn't nearly as much cross-national work, anyway, that tried to look at, well, when is there popular demand for these kinds of political roles for religious leaders? And so I just thought that it was also a scholarly opportunity. I had come across some of the comparative survey data in other research, and so I knew that there were at least some measures out there on the statistical side of things. And also had a sense that it might be a chance to put statistical analysis into conversation with some qualitative research too. So that was the other half. It just seemed like an argument that was ready to be made. A question that was kind of waiting to be asked, and that always helps when choosing what to do your research on.
Yeah, absolutely. You found an unfilled niche there, because as you're right, you know, I'm kind of chuckling that you say Carolyn Werner and Stathis Kalivas's work are classics, because they're of my generation. I'm like, oh, we're classics now. Yeah. You know, like, we're like Max Weber and stuff, you know. Oh, that's cool. But yeah, they focused on the supply side of this, how religious parties come about. A lot of the previous work on religion had been done on, well, let's survey religious people and see what they're thinking about abortion or free trade or something like that. So it's about finding the demand for policy preferences, but it's not the demand for the actual institutional connection with religion. And that, I think, is where you're really filling the gap here. And again, it's a great article. We'll point people back to it at our website. But here's what I have to ask you. When you talk about the demand for the clergy being involved in politics, what are we talking about here? Do priests actually get elected, or do they serve as cabinet ministers that are appointed by a prime minister or something? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, it's a fair question. I mean, some of it, we can talk more about the specific measures that especially the World Values Survey uses in a little bit. But at a more conceptual level, what I had in mind really was when would there be popular support for essentially a clerical veto status in the political realm, right? Like, when would there be popular support for clerics being able to determine governmental policy decisions or to determine election outcomes, right? So not necessarily. I think that it could be related to political parties, but I actually wanted to step a little bit away from the party realm, because we know that clerical influence isn't the same as religious political party influence, right? We know that even frequently those are in tension with each other. So I wanted to not make it about support for religious political parties, but focus on extra institutional veto influence for religious leaders. That's conceptually what I had in mind going into the project anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to explore that a little bit more. And in part, as you mentioned, part of the research is dictated by what the World Values Survey has there, at least on the quantitative side, but you get at some interesting qualitative results on your work in the Philippines and in a few other places as well. We'll get to that, but here's the interesting thing, and this revisits something that we just talked about a second ago. I mean, if you ask the general person on the street whether or not people want clergy to be involved in politics, my guess would be that folks who are really religious would probably have a desire for it because, you know, they really like their priests, their rabbis, their imams. They trust them. And you want somebody that you can trust in politics. So, yeah, you know, why not have them serve directly in government or have them as a veto player or having a big role, at least a consultation role in there? Is that what you're seeing? Are religious people really fond of seeing their religious leaders involved in politics deeply?
Yeah, no, I think that it's great. I mean, I think that is the common assumption, and maybe that says more just about where the United States is, right? And that's an assumption that would hold here. But what we see comparatively is just a lot more complicated than that. First of all, there's a lot of variation, right? We might think that that similarly religious people have similar demand for religious involvement in politics pretty much anywhere in the world. That's not the case. Actually, what I just sort of as a first look at the data in the article, I think it's important just to map out the, and that's why I put those maps in there, to map out the fact that, no, there's actually a lot of variation, even among people with similar levels of religiosity, depending on how you measure it. And that in and of itself supports the instincts that, well, there's just something more complicated going on here, right? And that clearly, when there's cross-national variation, there's an opportunity to ask questions about where that variation comes from and what helps to account for it.
Mm-hmm. So what does this cross-national variation look like? Again, we're not a visual medium here, so you'll have to describe these maps here and set up the color. Actually, I don't think they were in color in the article, were they?
That's funny. I do have the article. Let me scan up. They did. They used the blue.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Maps, at least in the I actually don't have the print copy.
Yeah.
But yeah, at least online they did get the blue shaded in there.
Yeah.
In terms of geographically, there are patterns that pop out in the data. Essentially, you get depending on how you measure on what particular source of variation you're interested in, you see slightly different patterns. In the article, one way that I try to measure this is to look at where the gaps between high religiosity and low religiosity people are the highest, right, in demand. And on that map, you see a fairly clear pattern, especially of sort of north-south variation. Biggest gaps in places in Western Europe, Scandinavia, and North America. Smaller gaps in places in the global south, more or less. You see a little bit of that also in the just looking at the high religiosity individuals, although you also get pockets of higher demand in parts of Latin America, for instance, as well as parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
And so you're using this thing called the World Value Survey. Right. And I'm familiar with it. I'm sure a few other people are, but a lot of people are not familiar with it. So what are we looking at in the World Value Survey that's allowing you to gauge religiosity and then also support for clerical influence in politics?
Sure. So World Value Survey is a, for those who aren't familiar, is a cross-national survey that gets run in different waves over time. Asks a whole range of questions. It's not a religion and politics survey in particular. Asks questions about economic development, asks questions about attitudes towards democracy, attitudes towards minorities, towards gender, you know, you name it. There's probably something in the World Value Survey that that is designed to capture it. In terms of measures of religiosity, World Value Survey has questions about religion's importance that they ask and sort of whether whether someone considers themselves a very religious person or not, and that's useful, right, as a measure of self-identified importance. They also have measures of religious behavior, in particular attendance at religious services. That is a cross-national indicator of religiosity. That's an indicator that, yeah, I think it's fair to say, probably is more valid as a measure of religiosity in Christian for Christian individuals, right? Where regular attendance is a more directly conceptually coherent measure. But I don't think that it's I don't think that it's invalid in other traditions. Actually, there's quite a high correlation between self-identified religiosity and religious attendance, even among non-Christian individuals.
Yeah, I mean, most major religions do have some kind of communal worship aspect to it, and you got to pay a cost to get up on Sunday, Saturday, or Friday and get in. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So those are the kinds of measures of religiosity that I look at cross nationally in the study. And then when it comes to capturing how people or what people think about religious leaders getting involved in politics, I look at two questions that in the fourth and fifth waves of the World Values Survey were asked. I actually don't believe that these are questions that were asked in the most recent wave. I would actually be happy to be proven wrong on that, but I think I took a look and they weren't asked this time around. But regardless, one's a question about agreement or disagreement with the idea that religious leaders should influence government decisions, and then a second question about religious leaders influencing how people vote. In the article, while those are conceptually different, I think, right, influencing, controlling government and controlling voting, when you run an index analysis on it, the alpha is really high. They load together, right? So they're actually probing the same underlying attitude, I think, about support for religious clerical control of politics. And so I merge those together into an index in the article, and that's what I'm then trying to explain variation in across countries.
Yeah, and it's a good use of those variables. And I've worked with the World Value Survey at times, and it's a little bit frustrating for those of us who don't study religion is that not all the questions are asked the same way in similar countries. Ron Engelhardt, who is one of the major engines behind running this thing, tends to kind of forget those in some countries. I know France for a while didn't have any questions on religiosity or had very few. Right. What was the coverage? Did you get all 195 countries or 200 countries in the world, or was it pretty spotty in terms of the sample that you could actually use?
It's not bad. So, but it's not everybody. You're right. And it's not only some places that you would expect it to not be, you know, maybe like China or something like that, where this is going to be the kind of thing that they might ask about. It is also some countries that drop out, where I honestly don't know the reason, but where you just don't have one of the questions for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Across the two waves, across the fourth and the fifth wave, these questions, all of the relevant questions, were asked in 78 countries.
That's good. That's good.
Some of those, and those are all individual countries. There's no repetition in those between the fourth and the fifth wave. If there was, I go with the more recent data, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's what you get. 78 countries. They do, you know, it's the World Value Survey, so they skew a little bit towards Western Europe. But it's not just Western Europe. You get several sub-Saharan African countries. You get several countries in South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, India, Indonesia, big ones, right, and huge countries when we're interested in studying religion and politics, India, Indonesia, and a number of countries in Latin America, too. So it's fairly good coverage, I think, on these questions. I was kind of pleasantly surprised by that, actually, when I looked in at the data.
And then when you did look at the data, you found this really interesting finding, somewhat counterintuitive, but, you know, maybe as you think through it, and you do this with your theoretical thinking in the paper, the more religious a population is, the less they tend to want their religious leaders working directly or influencing government. And now this calls for an explanation, and you might be the first one to come at it, but you, on the other hand, you're pretty sly here. You found out somebody else had argued that might not necessarily be the case. This guy named Alexis de Tocqueville, and you include him in an epigraph, a short little saying at the beginning of your article. How did you stumble across that epigraph, and how did you read Tocqueville on this one?
Yeah, it's great. It was so great, right? I mean, anytime that you can cite Tocqueville to anchor your argument, I think it's, makes you just, you might be onto something, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't have World Value Survey data, so how could he have known for sure?
I know. He's just guessing. Yeah.
I read Tocqueville actually in undergraduate, and again in grad school at Georgetown with people like Patrick Deneen while he was still on faculty at Georgetown. Had been pretty familiar with Tocqueville's analysis of the relationship between religion and politics in particular, not just democracy in a general sense in America, but in particular his arguments about the role of religion in American public life, and also in his analysis of France, right, in his other sort of classic work. the very different role that religion played in the Ancien Régime in France. So I had a basic familiarity with it, and I knew that, especially in his analysis of the American case, he was one of the things that he seemed to admire about American religious leaders is how they understood, or they seemed to understand, he thought, the risks of politicizing religion, for lack of a better word, and that because that didn't take place to such an extent in the United States, you had a more flourishing both political and religious scene. And so so I knew that that was in there in a general sense, and so I just went back and read it. It was fun to pull the political, well, it's not just, you know, it's not political theory and sort of macro-historical analysis off the shelf and look at what he had actually written about. And the basic instinct, I think, was the same, right, that religious leaders face risks when they get involved in politics. But, and this is where the variation comes in, right, that they might perceive those risks differently in some places than they do in others.
Yeah, you're right. The Tocqueville quote that you have, it is an observation that Tocqueville makes, but he really doesn't fill in the causal mechanisms, as we would say in social science. He hints at them, right? He hints that, oh, it could be dangerous, but he doesn't go much further than that. And that's what you do. You fill in those causal mechanisms really well. So explain to me why you see this interesting inverse relationship between the religiosity of a population and the population's demand for clerical influence in politics.
Yeah, well, I think it has to do with two things, both of which are loosely related to sort of the costs and benefits of religious influence over politics. I think that on the one hand, and they're both sort of social mechanisms as well, which I'm happy to talk a little bit about, but I really think that ultimately these are mechanisms that are about the kinds of social ties and the kinds of social organization that characterizes religion in high religiosity context as opposed to low religiosity context. So first, the first one I think has to do with in context of high general religiosity, there are alternative channels for religious communities to pursue their preferences without having to resort to relatively risky alliances with political parties and politicization of religion through the partisan sphere and things like that. So in other words, there are less risky, less costly avenues for pursuing more subtle forms of influence through especially elite networks that are quite strong in a lot of high religiosity contexts.
Now, what do you mean by that kind of alternative channels and through elite networks? Are we talking about a priest in clerical garb sneaking into the back of Congress late at night through a back door and saying, "Hey, psst, you got to pass this thing, Congressman"?
Sure, I think that frequently, honestly, it's less formal and more organic seeming anyway than that, right? It's a matter of even family ties, right? I mean, thinking back to historically the influence of the Irish Catholic Church. You wouldn't have had to sneak into the legislature because you would have been socializing together, right? Legislators and bishops. You would have been at the same pubs. You would have been at the same fundraisers and charity events, right? You would have been in the same social circles, and so there would have been no need to sneak around about it. It actually would have been just an organic part of social structure, right? And so it can be informal. I think that it's also more likely to also be formalized, though, in high religiosity settings, where you actually have institutionalized patterns through which, look, it's just expected that once a month, you know, you meet with the heads of the religious organizations. That's just what you do. And in those meetings, you might not give a vote necessarily, but you sound out preferences, right? And you may even sound out those preferences before issues even come on the agenda, right? So these are much more subtle patterns of influence that I think are much more realistic in high social religiosity settings. So I think that's part of the story. That's the first mechanism that I look at in the argument.
Okay. Now, actually, one of the things, too, and I didn't pick this up in your article, and I want to ask you about this, too, that it might not even be these connections, especially in democratic societies, and I'm thinking here in the United States, if you are in a congressional district that has a very religious population. You may say somewhere down in Southern Baptist, Alabama, somewhere. The politician will implicitly understand that if they want to get elected, you're not going to go against the will of the religious folks. So the priests don't even have to say anything. The pastors don't have to say anything. They just, you know, there's an understanding saying, no, you don't pass X, Y, and Z bills because that ain't going to sit well with our congregation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? I think it's I think it's right on, actually, right? It's even so it's a you don't even have to set the agenda because yeah. Everybody knows, right? Because everybody knows what it would be.
Yeah.
I think that's right on.
Okay. So what other mechanism we got working here too?
So the other half that I think, so if that's sort of about alternative means of pursuing the same preferences, the other half of it is about the costs that come with politicization. And it's that in higher religiosity settings, I think you're more likely to have, to run the risk that entering the political sphere actively brings internal division to the religious community. And risks all sorts of negative and unintended consequences. It might risk tainting the religious community with corruption scandals. You might just fail, right? You might just lose in your public bid. You also might divide believers against each other, right? So your opponents in public policy debates are not likely to be those people out there. They're likely to be the people who are in the pews and in the temple with you. On whatever day it might be, right? I think those risks are much more pronounced, or it's reasonable to expect anyway, that those risks are more pronounced in higher religiosity settings. And I think that then changes the ways in which your average person in the pews thinks about whether or not religious leaders should be getting involved in some of these political decisions.
Yeah. What about tainting the moral authority of clergy, too? If they start to become more outspoken and they start making trips to Washington, D.C., and no respect to your time in Washington, D.C., but, you know, D.C. can be a cesspool of corruption sometimes, and it's easy to get sucked into that cesspool. I mean, to become too close with the secular powers that be could really affect what the pastors are trying to do with respect to the eternal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that we, in political science, don't pay nearly enough attention to where religious authority comes from and how fragile it can be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Again, this kind of goes back to some of these essentialized assumptions about what religion is and what it should do in politics. Well, one assumption might be that religion should want political power. I think another assumption is frequently that religious people listen to what their leaders tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I think any pastor would tell you that authority is much more contingent, right, than you might think, and that therefore there's a real risk that authority can be damaged, particularly if you, especially in parts of the world with high levels of corruption and public disapproval and distrust in official political institutions, if you are seen as cozying up to or trying to gain control of those institutions. You risk a stain, right? A stain that's not just going to be political, but that could blow back even on your religious functions. And I think that most, not all, but most political scientists don't pay enough attention to that at all. I think, you know, in my experience, those risks in some ways are going to be perceived much more acutely by religious leaders. And prioritized above certain public policy goals. Right?
Yeah, I have an example of this too. In Argentina, the Catholic episcopacy curled up closely to the two authoritarian regimes they had there between the 60s and the 80s. And, you know, when it came out that the bishops were very in tight with the military leaders, it really, really damaged the credibility of the church, really set back the moral authority of the church, which, I mean, they had to spend a lot of effort to try to rebuild.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Right. So yeah, but, you know, sort of that the risks that this may pose to unity in the community and to the moral authority of religious institutions, I think are heightened in atmosphere in context of higher social religiosity.
Yeah. I think that's even a lesson too that was learned in the 1980s in the United States, where the Christian right, the moral majority of Jerry Falwell and the Pat Robertsons got too involved in politics, and it really took away from the message, the religious messages that they were trying to get across.
Yeah, well, and, you know, we've seen all this sort of interesting research start to come out of both sociology and American political science now, right, from like kind of Houghton Fisher and Putnam and Campbell, the idea that there's been sort of, that the rise of the unaffiliated, the famous rise of the nuns, right, is somehow tied up with a reaction against the rise of the religious right during the 80s and the 90s.
The other thing, too, that you mentioned as a possible risk, and I don't think you covered this, was the possibility of a backlash if you're on the losing side. What do you mean by that?
Well, there could be a couple of different ways that goes. On the one hand, in a context of democracy, right? If you make a bid and you lose, all of a sudden, when it comes time to grant institutional favors and things like that, you might be the out party, right? I think, though, that it's a risk that actually cuts across regime types. Several of the countries in the World Values Survey study would not be democratic, right? Different degrees depending on how you want to categorize them, but loosely would think of as authoritarian or competitive authoritarian regime. I think even there, though, there's a risk of backing the wrong internal faction within an authoritarian regime, or of just unstable dictator preferences, right? Dictators who are with you one day, but are not credible and could turn against you the next. And so I think that again, it's about understanding that religious leaders have a diverse set of incentives, actually, to tread carefully when it comes to political involvement. Yeah.
Yeah. So good observations here. I buy into your theory completely. I think the causal mechanisms are very well spelled out, that you have these informal channels that might work out just as effective as being there formally, and that the priests and that are calculating the risks. But the population is also understanding that too, right? Your question is really about the population telling clergy, hey, back away from this a little, right? We don't want you involved in politics. We want you in the pews. We want to see you on Sunday. How do you go about testing whether these causal mechanisms are really what's doing all the work here?
Yeah, well, I think it's a fair question, right? So, and I actually think it's, you know, transparency in research design. I think it's a weakness of the research design in the paper, is that the statistical test, right, is using public opinion data, and so that's the people, right, in the pews, at least as best we can tell. The qualitative evidence that I put on the table in the Philippines is more elite driven, right? Now I think it's elite to understand the mass dynamics, and so I try to, you know, that's how I try to frame things. But ultimately the there's a little bit of a mismatch there in the argument. I think though that the argument rests on kind of assumptions about information flows between elites and your average person in a congregation. The argument operates in part because there's an assumption that the average person in the congregation sort of understands what the elites are up to, and that the elites sort of understand the preferences of the average person in the congregation. That may not be true, actually, right? But I think that's kind of built into the argument, is a fair level of mutual understanding across authority levels within the religious communities. But in terms of the research design, I think it's fair to say that the qualitative evidence is more elite focused, right? In part because those are the kinds of interviews that I was doing for this research project, and others were more elite focused.
Okay, so let's talk about the Philippines, because you go and talk to a bunch of people, a bunch of elites out there, to figure out, are you calculating these costs and benefits? Do you have these backroom channels or informal channels of influence there? Why'd you choose the Philippines?
Well, the Philippines for this case it was kind of an on-the-line case, right? In the sense that it actually fits the expectations fairly well. You have fairly high religiosity, and you have fairly low demand for political involvement of religious leaders among the observant parts of the population. So we should expect to see the mechanisms operating. That's kind of the methods side. What got me into Philippine and the study of religion and politics in the Philippines is actually much broader than that. It's just a fascinating case to study the political influence of religious actors in kind of a post-authoritarian and now relatively consolidated democracy. It looks a lot like the Latin American cases, actually, that you have done so much work on. You know, Philippines' story of political development in some ways looks more like Latin America than it does like Southeast Asia. You have the Spanish colonial legacy. You know, you've got then the kind of unique American influence over the past 100 years or so. You've got the legacy of the influence of the Catholic Church, an overwhelmingly Catholic population, and so over time, I just got interested in it as a case where religious actors were very active in public life, but in, you know, kind of subtle ways. Right? So that's my background with the Philippine case.
And good food too, right?
Yeah, underrated food too, right? Well, I don't know. You're on the West Coast. Maybe you get more of it.
We do have more Filipino food out here. But yeah, I know scholars love to justify their, you know, research on, well, you know, the case of satisfies X, Y, and Z conditioning. But, you know, a lot of times we pick things because the food is good and, you know, the climate's pretty good too. A little warmer there than Louisville in the winter.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that I would pick Metro Manila for the climate, but, you know, it has its charm.
That's true. That is true. Okay, so you go down there, you're doing some interviews. Tell us about how you set these things up. Who are you talking to, and what are they saying?
So the particular sort of hook that I was focused on in the Philippine case was this controversy that they've had over the course of the past 5 years or so. I mean, it's been building for a couple of decades, but it really came to a fore in the past, like, 3 or 4 years, over a reproductive health bill, what they call the RH law, just short for reproductive health. Now, in the Philippines, when we talk about reproductive health policy, we're not talking about access to abortion, but what we are talking about is expanded access to contraception, and also expanded sex education in schools, and also changes in maternal health clinics and things like that. So it was a huge piece of legislation. It had implications for the education sector, for the healthcare sector, for the social service sector. It's a big, big, big bill. It was quite controversial, in particular with the Catholic hierarchy, because it essentially involved expanding, it essentially involved having the Philippine government's health service expand its coverage of contraceptives, right? And this, in theory, the point of this was that contraceptives were legal, but they weren't covered by the equivalent of Medicaid, and so a whole lot of Filipinos couldn't get them, right? And so the thinking from those in the pro-RH community was that, look, contraception's legal, but millions of people in our country can't get it, and so we need to expand access. The Catholic Church probably unsurprisingly found that argument unconvincing, right? And so had been a main opponent of the law. And it was a law that was eventually pushed through by the current Aquino administration, which is a little bit interesting because anybody who knows the Aquino name may associate it, right, with Cory Aquino, the leader who came in after the People Power Revolution, who was quite close to the institutional church, right? Well, the current president, her son, has a more nuanced relationship with the institutional church, I think it's fair to say. And so there was a huge brouhaha, but the law got passed. It is the end of the story. And so it was interesting to me to go over and try to talk to both Catholic leaders, leaders in the women's health movement, in the pro-contraception world, as well as religious minorities who didn't have a stake, really, in the contraceptive debate on theological grounds. But who were interested in the debate. So I kind of tried to cover those bases, sampling from elites who were in government within interest groups, and then in the interest group world, different religious elites as well as different elites with sort of public health and women's rights NGOs who were generally the opponents of the institutional church in those debates.
Now, you mentioned religious minorities. Who are we talking about here, Protestants or Muslims? Because there's a growing Muslim presence there.
There is, yeah. So the Philippines has a region, right, down in part of the island of Mindanao that it's Muslim majority, actually, that's been there for centuries. But because of population flows and the growth of Metro Manila and all of these things, there actually are now, there are Muslim communities more dispersed around the Philippines than there used to be. And so we are partially talking about national networks of ulama, of Muslim scholars, legal scholars, who in general were quite supportive of this law. They didn't have any particular ethical beef with contraceptive access. So that's part of what we're talking about. The other part of the story is different kinds of Protestants. And those can kind of be grouped together in two different parts. There are older Protestant communities, some of which are tied to American colonialism, so they're local branches of American Protestant denominations, basically. And there are also local, nationalized, sort of Protestant denominations, but that are essentially only, that basically only exist in the Philippines. So the Eglapayan Church is a phenomenon that you really only have in the Philippines. So you've got those sort of older non-Catholic Protestant or Christian minorities. You also have a newer batch of more evangelical sort of Pentecostal types. One of the interesting things about the Philippines is that that movement, in contrast to Latin America, hasn't really exploded in the same way. So you do have sort of newer evangelical Protestant actors, some of which have a lot of national visibility. But in terms of the share of the population, the Catholic Church is still, 80-85%. So you haven't seen the kind of competition in quite the same way that you have in parts of Latin America.
Okay. So you talk to these folks. You talk to some bishops. You talk to other religious leaders, the NGO folks on the other side. What are you asking them about, and what are you finding?
So what are they telling you? They're sort of on the two mechanisms. On the first one, what I wanted to see was, okay, so this is a sort of high religiosity environment. So do we see that these kinds of networks, these kinds of informal patterns of consultation actually exist? And it turns out that they do. And actually, while it was a very controversial debate, there's no doubt about it, by the end, you have the head of the Catholic Bishops Conference of the Philippines saying that, well, while we disagree with the legislation, we can agree that we have shared interests with many of the allies of this bill and we'll work together on other issues. Right? It doesn't turn into some sort of a total breakdown in the religion-state relationship. Well, why is that? Well, it's because in subtle negotiations that were going on with the authors of the legislation, Catholic elites, both sort of official bishops and also lay people acting on behalf of the bishops, got changes made in the legislation. They tended to be subtle changes. They weren't changes that were going to do away with the key goal of the legislation of expanding access to contraception. But they were changes, for instance, to the conscience protections given to individuals working in hospitals. There were changes to the way in which religious schools were talked about when it came to sex education requirements. Right? All of these changes that were made, you could directly trace to networks of consultation and social relationship that tied political elites to religious actors, right? And many of these, almost all of these networks actually pre-existed this particular controversy, right? So these are networks, social networks, networks tied to one organization called the Bishops Businessmen's Conference for Human Development, that exist for other reasons because it's a high religiosity society. But that when a controversy kicked up, helped to subtly take some of the steam out of it anyway. So that was part of it, was talking to people who were in these networks about, well, what went on in these negotiations, what got changed, what didn't change, yada, yada. And hopefully through the interviews also triangulating a substantive agreement, even from people who might have incentives to disagree, right? So when you can get people from the women's movement and people from the institutional church to give you basically the same story about what happened, you feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, and that does boost your argument there, that there are these informal networks and they're talking about that. Do they ever get down to the nitty-gritty details saying, oh, yeah, we were at this one party or we were at this one tavern and I was talking to so-and-so and, you know, they weren't sure what to do. And, you know, I took my little bishop elbow and nudged him a little bit and say, why don't you change that conscious clause a little bit? I mean, did it ever get down to that nitty-gritty detail?
You know, I don't know if I got any, like, great juicy stories about exactly where it happened, but I mean, I will say that that are sort of super sexy. The one we all like, good Jesuit story, right? Those nefarious Jesuits acting in all of these sort of ways. One of the institutions that really, I say this as a product of Jesuit education, by the way, for our listeners, don't, you know, no hate mail. But anyway, one of the interesting locations where a lot of these negotiations took place was actually the major Jesuit university in Metro Manila, Ateneo de Manila University. Where you had sort of a ready-made excuse for political leaders and religious leaders to come together. A lot of the political leaders would be alums of Ateneo. They would have children who are at Ateneo. They would have a reason to be on campus from time to time. It wouldn't be unusual for them to be there. And so during those kinds of campus outings, you could have conversations with the ethicists who were tied to the Loyola School of Theology, to the theology school that did the Ateneo, where a lot of these kinds of informal consultations could take place. And some formal ones, too. They had some public events and things like that. So I think that in terms of a concrete place, that's actually the one that stands out. There are others as well, other universities and other sort of social clubs. But I think really that is where the center of gravity in a lot of these negotiations was.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, too, given you know, where your graduate education was in Georgetown, because that really is a, you know, Georgetown is a major influence of Catholic thought and how it connects to Washington, D.C. It's not just a basketball school. It's a place where these informal negotiations and talks and discussions all tend to play out.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're also, this gets a bit into the weeds, but, you know, the Jesuits as a religious order within the Catholic Church have a level of autonomy and an ability to serve as a kind of broker and a bit of freedom that sometimes the official bishops' conferences themselves might have a harder time doing. It's you know, part of the diversity within the institutional Catholic Church that's not news to Catholics or to people who study those communities, maybe within religious studies, but that, again, you know, political scientists tend to sort of lump religious communities together as relatively unitary actors, and that diversity is actually important to account for.
Yeah, excellent observation there. What about the other aspect of your causal theory here, the concern over risks? You talking to some of these bishops and other religious leaders, are they expressing this kind of concern that, well, if we get too close to this, we're going to hurt ourselves in the long term or something?
Yeah, I think there's a real sense from even opponents of the RH law that I heard that there was risk to sort of sowing division within the Catholic community. That was what I heard most consistently on the ground, was that, look, you know, President Aquino is a Catholic. He's quite close with Cardinal Tagle. Risa Ontiveros, one of the leaders of one of the left-leaning parties and a leading advocate of the RH bill is a product of Ateneo and somebody who takes her Catholicism very seriously. Any number of the leading advocates of the RH law weren't sort of secularist boogeymen or boogeywomen who hated the institutional church. It was just so obvious that that was true, that there really was a sense that that stepping too far into the political game would sow real division, and that was a risk to the religious mission of the Catholic Church that needed to be taken seriously, and that would be counterproductive to the religious mission of the institution. So I think that was the one that I heard the most. Right, was that that because it's such a high religiosity society, even opponents who might, you know, really not get along very well, particularly on this particular issue, had a sense of that there was diversity within their own communities, and that placed some check on their activity. Or if it didn't place a check on it, there was a real risk of division as a result of it.
Let me go ahead and ask you to do some speculation here and step outside the article a little bit. This is always dangerous for social scientists, but we are a program of danger here. So in terms of generalizing this, and again, most of your work, you've done the quantitative work, so you see the numbers come by on the computer screen. You've done the qualitative work in the Philippines. But how do you think this transports to other areas of the world, not only Christian areas of the world, but let's say the Muslim world? How do you think your theory transports?
Yeah, I think, in the Muslim world, the case that I've thought the most about and spent the most time in is Senegal. And I do think that you see some of the same thing going on there. Again, highly religious society. And one where there's no doubt that religious groups have a lot of sort of informal influence. But where you've seen over the past 10 years or so, religious elites actually step back from essentially playing party politics, endorsing candidates and that sort of thing. Some of that goes on at the lower levels of the religious hierarchies of the Islamic Sufi brotherhoods, but at the highest levels, the elites have tried to step back, and in particular in the most important recent election, it's been a few years now, but between current President Macky Sall and the former President Abdoulaye Wade, you had the leader of the most important Sufi Brotherhood, the Murid Brotherhood, explicitly choose not to endorse a candidate in the final days of a very contentious campaign, because he knew, right, that not only might his candidate lose, but that the candidate who wanted the endorsement was somebody who was seen as kind of corrupt, and there were a lot of allegations against him, and there had been protests, et cetera, right? So that's one case that comes immediately to mind where, I think that religious leaders outside of Christian and Catholic settings face some of these same dilemmas, right? Face some of these same challenges about balancing political engagement with the risks that it brings to their religious communities. I think that in terms of the U.S. case, for instance, right? One of the things that's interesting to think about is as the unaffiliated grow as a share of the population, will it be the case that U.S. religious leaders, at least some of them, actually become more tolerant of these kinds of risks, right, because they don't have alternatives anymore? Yeah. And that'll be interesting to see. One reaction, for instance, from evangelical leaders to some of this blowback to the religious right, et cetera, could be to go the quietistic route, right, to say, nope, this is bad, we got to get out of this. But another reaction could be to sort of double down, actually, to jump in with two feet in the face of what's perceived as a more hostile social environment as religiosity declines. And it'll be interesting to see how that goes over the course of the next 10 to 15 years in the U.S.
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask you closing up, just kind of how you read the current American scene. But what you just did is tee up a really nice research agenda for you in the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, well, let's hope that we make it that long. I think there's a lot of work to do in this area. I really do.
No.
So I think it's hopefully an area of scholarship that other folks will get serious about looking at and arguing about.
No, and you certainly do add a lot to the discussion here in the literature. And again, I will point people back to some of your work. You can visit our site at www.researchonreligion.org to find some links to Dave Buckley and all the stuff that he is doing. So I want to say, Dave, thanks for being on Research on Religion today.
Thanks a lot, sir. Yeah, it was great to be here. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.